Hello, and welcome to The Trumpet, the official podcast of Elephant Room Productions. As always, I am your host, Robert Gene Pelleccio, back after a slight hiatus. I think we all kind of mutually agreed, without saying anything at Elephant Room Productions, that we needed a quick breather after the amazing work we did in New York with five different plays all coming together in one. But we are back at it. We have not stopped our ears program. And joining us this month, we have Jonathan Alexandratos.
Did I say that correctly? You nailed it.
My last name is Pelleccio, so I totally identify with the never hearing your name correctly club. So I'm glad I am not I'm not a member of it for you.
No, totally. Anyway, you're good.
Jonathan is a New York-based playwright who recently shared a very, very fascinating and very unique piece with us called Ground Effect, which we will talk about at length in a little bit. But for now, as we always start, Jonathan, would you mind just giving us a little bit about your theater background?
Sure, yeah. So first of all, thank you for having me on. It's great to be here, and it's awesome to have you have read my script. I started my theater work in, let's say, third grade, when I was performing plays in the sort of basement of my Greek Orthodox church in Knoxville, Tennessee. The plays were all in Greek, and I understood exactly none of what I was saying. The plays were really weird. It's not like they were ancient Greek scripts. I think they were like plays that people who like worked at the church had written or something. Right. I could be totally wrong about that. But
and they were all just completely Greek.
Yeah, yeah, because the point was for me to learn Greek, which I never did. I don't know why. I don't know why that didn't take.
Not to cut in. I usually don't cut in this early.
No,
but like,
please.
One would think if the purpose was to teach the language, you would have a translation.
Yeah, you'd think so, huh? Right.
Like, I understand performing it in Greek, but like, ideally you learn even the context of the scene first.
Yeah, so here's what I remember. There was a moment where I was dressed as a Greek soldier, which I think is just delightfully queer, although I wouldn't have called it that then. I was too scared being in the South. But, like, you know, there's a skirt and there's tights and there's cool shoes. And I'm into the look, don't get me wrong. But
right.
I didn't know what I was doing. And then at one point, we took out pop guns, like cap guns, and we shot a priest in the play. And I still, to this day, have no idea why we did that. That's a bit intense for third graders, but,
yeah.
You know. Somewhat. Yeah, yeah. But so that was that was my entrance, my big debut. And then in middle school, I started writing Star Trek spoofs with my friends, and we started to film those. And then later on in high school, as I drifted more into the realm of being kind of a loner, I just started writing plays by myself because I was too scared to eat lunch with the other kids. And then I just continued doing that through college and then into grad school when I sort of came out of my shell a bit more and eventually really started writing about myself. Like, that really didn't start happening until much later. I was pretty obsessed with the idea of like writing the farthest thing from me because I wanted to escape sort of who I was and my real. I didn't want to deal with that.
Right.
So I'd much rather just live some fantasy. But what I really didn't realize was in the process of doing that, not only was I ignoring myself, but I was also appropriating other stories. And I really had no right to do that. So I had a really great teacher in grad school, two of them actually. One was Tina Howe at Hunter, and the other is Richard Schotter at Queens College here in New York. And they really got me to focus inward and sort of ask me questions about like, well, what does this have to do with you? And why do you need to tell this story? And then I realized, oh my God, okay. So there's all this stuff inside of me and I should tell those stories. I should mind that.
Nice.
And that was really, really helpful in writing something like Ground Effect, which is super personal. And thinking about, well, who am I? And how can I express that theatrically? So that stuff like that kind of worked through all of my professional theater career. I was at Nashville Rep as an Ingram New Works playwright for a season where I furthered that. I got a Queens Council on the Arts grant to work on some other aspects of my family on stage. I'm continuing to kind of mind that, and I'm lucky that theaters have kind of given me the chance to. Theaters such as yours, in fact.
Oh, yeah. Well, you've done most of the beginning of my job for me, because I generally ask about the transition from acting to playwriting, or if there is a transition, you jump right in. So thank you. Do you consider yourself primarily or just solely a playwright now, or do you still explore those other avenues? I know you mentioned performance back in the day.
I would say I'm three things. Let's say four things. I would say I'm a playwright. I'm an academic essay writer. I'm a toy collector, and I'm a teacher. Not necessarily in that order all the time, right, but those are the four things that I am. So,
what kind of toys, if you don't mind me asking?
Oh my gosh! So, if I could have my camera working right now, you would see behind me some of my G1 Transformers.
I was gonna ask about Transformers.
Yeah, so that's definitely part of it. But I mean, Barbie, G.I. Joe, Transformers. I get a real charge out of busting down the gender lines in toys. So I got everything. Happy Meal toys, as you might have picked up from the script. I just got recently a doll that I'm obsessed with called Capsule Chicks, which is basically they come in this kind of machine and you twist the handle and the doll kind of comes out in parts and you build the doll yourself. And it's really cool.
Interesting.
It's got like silver hair and everything. So I'm into all of it. That's all that sort of kind of comes together, I think, in my playwriting. Like, I think playwriting is the nexus of kind of everything that I do, because toys go into that. I do want to teach, but not in kind of a didactic or boring or dull way. Like, I want to invite people into a safe room where we can sort of learn about each other, like where we kind of feel safe doing that. Like, hopefully by, you know, sharing maybe my story, other people will be encouraged to kind of connect. And I think it's that kind of learning that I'm most interested in. So, like, you know, I don't want to just sort of narrate the War of 1812, although,
right,
you know, important, but like, I want more to just help us learn from each other.
I think it's funny you bring up your toy collection, because I mention a lot on this podcast about the stories I told with my toys growing up. And actually, even in the last episode, Emery Schaefer, playwright, was I think the closest I've ever gotten to like really finally being pushed off the deep end and just becoming a playwright, because we kept talking about all these stories that are in our heads. And I mention all the time that my experience playing with toys as a kid was not your average bang bang, I'm gonna get you, rawr, Optimus, blah blah blah. I had very intricate storylines and character creations
and
stuff. The reason I bring that up now, I bring it up almost every episode, and people are probably getting sick of hearing it, but just hearing you describe them makes me think, for the 4% of people who listen to this that would actually appreciate this, I don't think I've ever actually listed out the various worlds I had combined. So there were obviously Transformers was obviously the main crux of the world.
Sure.
Dragon Ball Z was folded into there. There was some Star Wars.
When you say Transformers, are we talking G1 or are you doing like
I jumped in at Armada. So that was most of my Transformers knowledge came from Armada and then just kind of branched backwards. But it was, you know, kind of the fundamental elements of that with Digimon, Dragon Ball Z, Star Wars, maybe a little Harry Potter, because I think I had a Voldemort toy. And it was one of those things where Yu-Gi-Oh! Of course was also involved. But I basically took various facets of every rules of every one of those worlds. So I had Dragon Balls, I had to go with the rules of death there, combined with the Shadow Realm of Yu-Gi-Oh!, combined with the character relationship of Transformers. And it was a really interesting story that I wish I could remember and just write out. the biggest flaw, and I don't know if you came across this in your toy playing, but everybody loves a redemption arc, and yeah. more often than not, many villainous characters ended up joining the Z Fighter / Autobot team at the end, to the point where, and I know you'll appreciate this just based on the nerd things you've just mentioned. There was a point where I realized, oh, I'm running out of villains because it's basically just Megatron and Bobbity, and that's it.
Uh-huh.
So yeah. I basically, because everybody else had turned, so I created an arc where, I don't remember who it was, I feel like it was Bobbity or Megatron, gathered the Dragon Balls to wish that anybody who had ever been a villain reverted to their evil nature, and it yeah. just rebalanced the playing field. And the thing I didn't realize while I was writing that is technically that also includes Goku.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I think with my playing, I was more interested in having them all have sex with each other. And I don't know. Like, I think that they were all just looking for a Lego house in which they could kind of have some privacy. And then finally Catwoman and like Optimus Prime could finally get together. But, you know.
I both want to and don't want to know how that works.
Yeah, I know, right?
but also, you know, stick around after this call because I have some questions.
Excellent. Yeah. It's I mean, for sure, like I recognize the type of play you're talking about very, very well. And I do think that the bad guys were typically the coolest. You know, the first action figure I ever really remember picking out for myself was the Crimson Guard Immortal action figure from 1992's G.I. Joe Real American Hero. And what I remember really about that I sort of reflect upon, I have a show called Toys 101 where I talk about all this stuff. I reflect upon now how that character, when I play with them now, it can be a gender neutral character, honestly. Like, there's really, you can't see anything of the character's physical features underneath the armor. So you can kind of make that character into anyone you want. Now, you can do that with the characters who don't have armor as well, because there's really right. no look to queerness. You can, you know, look however you want to look. But with the Crimson Guard Immortal, the mystery behind what this person really looked like just created so much play space for me. And that only intensified as I grew. Like, I think I'm still just fundamentally playing with my action figures when I sit down to write anything.
You reminded me of one of the biggest complaints that Gwendolyn Christie got from Force Awakens when people, because that character, and I wish I could remember her name offhand. She was
Captain Phasma.
Phasma, that's what it was. Yeah. You know what? I was going to say it, but I thought I was wrong. But yeah, that character was originally, the idea of the character was originally to make it male. And right. when she auditioned, or when they brought her in, whatever, they realized that it would change 0% of the story if they right. cast woman in this part. And everybody, you know, pooped their pants about it, and they were like, well, that the armor isn't feminine, and their yeah. response was, it's armor and it's on a woman, therefore yeah. it's female armor. Well, I don't right. know what you want.
Right. There's really no reason you have to have breasts cut out into the armor. That's kind of a baffling choice most of the time. Like, I can't imagine that's more comfortable.
I mean, really, when you get down to it, and I think I've seen people make this argument before, it's those female warrior characters are more or less, like, I think it reads that they are more badass because every male character in those games and movies is covered from head to toe in armor. Yeah. And then we have skimpy armorless woman come out being like, what you need to cover up? No, I got this. Let me at him.
Right. Right. Sure. Sure. Well, yeah. I mean, it's true. And of course, like, those conversations like that, conversations about characters like Phasma. I mean, I think that thinking about characters like that from a sort of trans angle, because I mean, especially when we look at Star Wars, there really isn't much transness actually to go on in the text. So
right.
We sort of have to do
a lot of kind of our own stuff.
Yeah, that kind of thing. So I always kind of find it just liberating to be like, well, you know, physical look doesn't really tell you that much. Like you can kind of, it's all about sort of how someone feels and who they are, you know, on the inside. And the more we can keep exploring that, the better.
Well, before we segue to ground effect, because it sounds like we're nearing that. I just want to ask how long have you been writing, and what is your general style?
Yeah, so I guess I first started really writing when I was 15, and that was when I really needed the friends. I mean, they were all imaginary friends that I sort of was writing, and at that point, it was like strictly Christopher Durang plagiarism. That was pretty much all I was writing as a 15-year-old. But then, like later, and let's just sort of cut to now. Now, I would say that I like an aspect of poetry in what I write. I like an aspect of finding the sort of magical in the real. So I guess magical realism is kind of a part of what I do. I really enjoy that. I like playing with the space on the page. I like playing with what things might represent and what things might actually do. And I sort of live for the last moment of a play. Like before I sit down to write anything, I want to know what the last final tableau is, because if that tableau doesn't move me, then I don't really want to write it, because that image has to be something where I feel like I've earned that. Like the last scene in another play of mine called Duck is where all of these actors who have been wearing animal masks the whole play, performing as different animals, they just all sort of take off their masks in unison. And I wanted to think, okay, what story could I write that would make that feel earned, like that moment of just ripping a mask off your face, like and that, you know, I think conventionally might seem like such a simple thing to do, but if you think of the metaphor and if you think of the sort of texture of something like that, there's a lot you have to do to like actually tear off your own mask, and so I wanted that, and I think the whole play is a quest to get there. And Ground Effect is a good example too. I mean, I wanted something where the final scene, a character turns into an airplane. That's what we got.
Well, I'm trying to think of a bad airplane pun, got in the wrong way. No, I'm sorry. I'm not going to half-ass a pun. Now
dramaturgical discussion.
Can you just kind of tell us a little bit about the premise of Ground Effect, and then just set up the scene that we're going to be listening to?
Yeah, sure. So Ground Effect came from a number of places. So I grew up in Knoxville, Tennessee, like I said, and most of my sort of family trips and things went out towards like Dollywood, Sevierville, Gatlinburg, like that area. And as a kid, we never really ventured too far into the mountains except on some school trips and things. But I do remember that being a very pivotal part of my growing up, my coming of age in Knoxville. And then the fire happened. So the actual fire happened in, I want to say, 2016. A huge chunk of the Gatlinburg, Sevierville area burned. And that I actually found that more traumatic than I thought. And I had to actually think about why. Like, I didn't live there at the time. I mean, people lost everything. And I luckily I wasn't one of those people, but I still really felt deeply for them. And I felt like it was because there was a piece of me kind of still there. And I wanted to write about that piece, the piece of me that sort of found myself there in a community that can sometimes be in some ways a little hostile, maybe to folks who are in any way kind of different, but in other ways, like the communities there of queer people, of people of color, which I am not, but Phoebe in the script is, are very strong, and they don't get enough recognition on stage. They don't get enough recognition. All we talk about is kind of the opioid crisis, which is huge and deeply, deeply, deeply important. I know you did a series on that, and I'm grateful that you did. But I think that talking also about the strength and the resilience and the triumph of some of the people there was something I was deeply interested in. So that sort of spun into Ground Effect, and the more I read, just the more urgent that play kind of felt. So I read J.D. Vance's Hillbilly Elegy, and I took huge issue with that, like that specific sort of very white, very straight, very cishet narrative of Appalachia. And then I sort of read follow-ups to that from other authors. There's one book called, I think it's like What You Get Wrong About Appalachia. I might be getting that title wrong, but it's along those lines. It's really, really good. That, along with the blog Queer Appalachia, talk a lot about all of the communities, all the queer communities, all the otherwise sort of marginalized communities that live in Appalachia and who thrive there and find their footing and have for many, many, many years. And that's what I knew. Like, that's what I wanted to bring to the stage, because that's a little bit how I felt, and even more so how other people that I knew felt.
Nice. And can you tell us a little bit about the scene we're going to be listening to today?
Sure. So the scene is going to be between Seal, who is the non-binary protagonist of the play, who has this ability to turn into a plane. And they are telling Phoebe, who is a Black female cop who basically lives next door, this. So Phoebe is learning this for the first time from Seal, that Seal is able to transform into a plane, and Seal essentially has this monologue about how that's possible and for how long that's been possible, and why that's such a tough thing for them to say. Basically Phoebe kind of hears that, takes it in, and basically they sort of see eye to eye after that.
Great. All right, let's take a listen.
I'm going to ask you a question, and please keep in mind that you're being asked this by a short-haired, old, Black lady detective who just wants to get you right. Like, you want to get me right. Honey, are you a boy or a girl?
I don't think I've ever been asked that. I mean, as an adult, as a kid, people didn't know what to do with me.
But you've asked yourself that, haven't you?
I don't know that I ever posed the question, but I have told myself all sorts of answers over the years.
And what's the answer you tell yourself now?
This feels like I'm under investigation.
Would it be easier to tell me if you were? Because we can play it that way.
Yes.
All right. Then this is officially a very official thing we're doing here, and I want you to tell me.
Okay, so see this two-way airport thing? I've been building this since I was a kid. It all started because I got this one toy. It was one of those Happy Meal toys, you know, like you get from McDonald's. I was like 8, and they had one of those ones, Barbie or Hot Wheels. Remember that? Mm-hmm. Barbies or Hot Wheels. And the Barbie was like the girl's toy, and the Hot Wheels was like the boy's toy. Which, I mean, what a horrible position you put on those poor workers in, right? Like, they work 12-hour shifts for minimum wage, and now they gotta gender your kid too? Anyway, of course they couldn't tell with me, because I look somewhere between Chucky and Bride of Chucky, so that meant I got Hot Wheels. I sat down, opened it up. My mom was furious. How could you get a Hot Wheels? You're a girl. You were supposed to get a Barbie. Those damn burger flippers. They can't see a girl when one's slapping them in the face. Thank God this was before their cell phone videos, because this shit would have been all up on YouTube. Anyway, we were asked to leave the establishment, and I kept my little Hot Wheels plane, which I loved. It was a plane. I thought Hot Wheels was just cars, but it was a plane. And this little plane created this whole thing. My mom got all upset, maybe because on some level she knew I wasn't ever gonna look like what she expected me to look like. But also because it was everything I was just boiled down into a tiny little thing. They say she, McDonald says he, my mom said no, now I say they. I got a charge out of that. So I told this little plane that I'd build them an airport and all sorts of other stuff would fly in and out and they could fly in and out. I did that, and when it was basically done, something kind of crazy happened. I transformed into a plane. The little toy plane. It felt like a thank you. Like this little toy plane wanted me to feel how it felt. To finally have a place to land. So it made me into a toy plane too. And I flew around my bedroom and I felt the lift all around me holding me up. I controlled my descent and landed smoothly. I could barely tell I was on the strip of cardboard I laid down as a runway. And once I came to a halt, I was allowed one last wisp of air to course over my wings. And I unfolded back into my person. That's when I knew I was a them. Because if there's an airplane in here, I didn't have to just be one thing anymore. So if my gender is anything, it's this little plane.
I get it.
I was hoping you might.
Not everyone would.
Tell me about it.
But the whole expected to be one thing, but you gone and done another, obviously, I get that.
I'm not the same plane I was then. I crashed. And I'm so terrified I'll crash again. I read about plane crashes. All of them. Ever. Because I think maybe it'll save me from the dangers of life as who I am.
Well, that's a real impulse we all have.
And we're back. So first things first. I don't say this lightly. There was a general consensus, I think, amongst everybody who read this play, that it was ready for the next step. And I would wait until the end of discussing the piece to mention that. But this is for a play about a non-binary character that can turn into a plane, it's a surprisingly grounded and really honest and really unique story. So you talked a little bit about the influence behind it before we listened to the scene, but now that we've heard it, can you tell me a little bit about the creation of CL and where they came from?
Yeah, so I think they came from me. I mean, I was feeling a lot of the feelings that they do. That bit about getting the Barbie from the McDonald's as a kid, and then sort of having your mom swat that away and making sure you got the Hot Wheels because that's, you know, that's the boy toy. That really happened to me. And you know, it's one of those things that is just sort of ingrained in my memory banks, and it gets me to think about how from an early age being my assigned gender was so important, and I never knew any other alternative. And I had experiences, not to the same extent that Seal has, thankfully, but I've had experiences where, like, you tell people that, and the result is sort of either confusion or rejection or something like that. And it's really, really tough. Really, really tough to go through that. Because really what you're just saying is, at least in my case, what I'm saying is, look, you know, when I was born, all of these expectations were put upon me based on sort of genitalia, essentially. And over the course of my life, I've never really naturally gravitated towards any of those. Now, plenty of men don't. And that's, I think, totally fine. But once I started learning the language of being non-binary and what that was like really late in my life, actually, like in grad school, I broke down crying. Like, and I think that, like, once you have that reaction to something, you at least have to stop for a second and say, okay, what about this gives me that reaction? And early on, I just thought, oh, I just happen to be really moved by these stories. But then the more I thought about it and the more I sort of started giving my permission to embrace the language myself, the more it felt super, super, super right. You know, some people have explained transness and gender in terms of handedness, like being left-handed or right-handed. You don't really know, like, necessarily why you are. You just know that, like, when you start writing with your right hand, it don't look so good anymore. And, you know, because I'm left-handed, so that would apply to me. Okay. if you're right-handed, obviously, it's maybe the opposite. So it was that. It was that feeling of just sort of, well, it just doesn't feel right any other way. And I wanted to take that feeling and give it to Seal. Now, I think the question from there is, why transform into a plane, perhaps?
My next question.
Yeah. Which is a totally valid question. And I think that what I wanted was, first of all, I didn't want to make this a story about somebody just coming out as non-binary. I wanted them to be right. Non-binary.
Which I will say I really, really liked.
Cool.
I am trans issues and gender issues are things that I feel very passionate about. And it's something I've felt very passionate about for a long time. And it's always been odd to me because I myself do not identify as trans or non-binary. I am very much cisgendered. And there was something just really compelled me about the issues at hand. And it was one of those things where it's like, how often do you see a celebrity promote a cause or a disease that doesn't personally affect them or their family?
Right.
So it was, for me, it was not comparing anything to a disease. I was just,
no.
For me, it was the thing. It was like, it really stuck with me from a very, you know, early point. And even though I did not have any, at the time, personal connection to anyone in my life, I just knew it was an issue that was being kind of swept under the rug and not really talked about. And I am so, it moves my heart so much to see more and more representation in film, in theater, just in, even in life, of this wider spectrum that we don't talk about.
Me too. I mean, there's a whole unit of people now at the Public Theater here in New York that are trans, that are non-binary, that are dedicated playwrights and they're dedicated to changing this. A good friend of mine, Ashley Rogers, is in that, and they're doing a ton of work to change this whole dynamic that we have now and really open it up. And I love that. I love that. So it motivates me as well. It motivates me personally to really embrace and try aspects of myself out that I've never really given myself permission to try. I think that was it. Like, I'm very permission-based, I think, as a human. Like, I almost need someone to say, you can do this. And I think Seal is kind of like that too. Like, I think that they need also somebody to be like, you can do this. So I think for Seal, the more outrageous the this is, the more significant the acceptance is. So if you come to someone and you say, I can turn into a plane, you want to see, their answer is either going to be, you're crazy, or no, or that sounds gross. And so that reaction is the best way I could communicate the rejection I felt in my life. Like, it's not so much saying I'm non-binary where people go like, huh, what? It's more like saying I can turn into a plane. And even though I think turning into a plane is really cool, just like I think being non-binary is actually really cool. In fact, I think being your true self, no matter who that is really cool. I think that people react with sort of aversion, and it's like, I can, this isn't going to hurt you. Like I know what I'm doing. It's okay. But you get pushed down so much, and it really just after a while feels like when you say you're trans, when you say you're non-binary, in certain circumstances, it feels like you're saying something that is just so repulsive, and you are not, you are saying a truth about yourself that is one of the most beautiful things you can tell people. And in fact, just you just now saying you're cisgender is one of the most beautiful things you could tell someone about yourself, because that's who you are. And I think that nobody's got a right to put that down. So I was going to say, well, let's not talk about necessarily them coming out as non-binary. Let's say that they're a plane, and let's really get people to like to confront that.
What I think is neat, really neat, is that you almost get the best of both worlds with that, because on the one, it's clear, you know, there's clearly allegory at work here. And by using that as the allegory, I think you're able to very successfully convey what that feels like, while at the same time having them at their core be open about being non-binary, just from the get-go. And what I really like about CL, which, by the way, I just realized I have been pronouncing their name wrong this whole time. I've been saying CL. Is it Seal?
I've always said Seal, yeah.
Okay. What I love the most about Seal is that there's not a lot of hand-holding, and there's not a lot of, you know, delicate guiding in. They are just, right at the offset, they are who they are.
My feeling on that is we all got Google, you know, it's all on your phone. Most people are on their phones at the theaters anyway, and they usually sit right next to me while they're doing it. So go ahead and just Google non-binary.
Was it Godspell on Broadway a couple years ago? They had the tweet seats in the back they were like, listen, we know you're not going to turn your phone off. If you have to do it, here are two rows in the very back of the theater that are specifically set aside for you and your phone.
Yeah, and you know, I'm not too into necessarily policing too many people at the theater, but I almost do kind of want to say, look, if you're going to Google, why don't you just Google, like, can you Google trans stuff? Can you Google non-binary stuff? And that way you'll just learn about that. And because you came to a non-binary show for some reason. So,
and something that I think we don't get enough of in trans and gender issue theater. And I think what really helps you, I think you hit it on the head earlier. I am very much of the mindset that anyone should be able to tell any story that they want to tell, as long as they, even if it's not their story, as long as it is treated with, respect and due diligence and research. But in your case, it is so much of a stronger statement that you are speaking from a place of yourself and putting yourself into this work. I oftentimes see, especially in newer works, I don't know, it's almost the idea of the idea of a character being trans or non-binary, something like that, it sometimes feels like too much of a reveal. And it's a dramatic turn of, and guess what? Drum roll, please. I'm trans. Which is, I'm very fortunate to have people of many facets of the gender identity spectrum in my life. And I have never had a conversation with any of them that has ramped up like that.
Right. Right, exactly. I mean, I think that's really important to recognize, and to recognize that how a person identifies, you know, and who they are, and the language that they use to describe who they are can also change. So, you know, we can come out as trans, we can come out as non-binary, and I'm in a bunch of sort of non-binary Facebook groups, and, you know, in there people will sometimes post and they'll say, you know what, today I actually realized that I'm a trans man. I'm not non-binary, and you know, do I have to leave the group? And people are like, no, 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 you don't have to leave the group at all. You're still totally welcome here. But you know, because the way in which we describe ourselves can change, and we're just trying to do the best we can with the vocabulary mm-hmm. that we have, and nobody has to gatekeep or anything like that. We just have to be accepting of the fact that, you know, these sorts of coming out stories, they might not even necessarily just happen once in your life. So to present it as like a drum roll, please, I'm trans kind of thing, just actually kind of eradicates the rest of that person's life in a way, because we don't know what's coming, and they could identify and be that the rest of their lives, or it can change. And I think that once we start treating it for what it is, which is just information, really important information about who someone is in a given moment, then the more we can kind of start to normalize it. You know, I mean, it's, you remember even in class, even if you were in class in like elementary school or middle school, and you said something that was the right answer, and even if it was a good thing, and the teacher said, oh, wow, that's so great, that's amazing, and everybody's head in the classroom turned around to look at you, you kind of felt embarrassed even in that moment, even if you said something good.
Yeah.
So the more we start to treat it as like, yep, we're celebrating transness as a thing, but you know what? For trans folks, we're going to give them exactly, you know, what they need. And if somebody wants to throw a party, go for it. I'll be the first attendee. But if somebody wants to come out as trans and just sort of say, hey, you know, this is who I am, but we don't need to necessarily make a huge deal out of it right now, I'm cool with that too. You know, it's all just about what that trans person might need in the moment. And I haven't met a ton, myself included, who necessarily want, you know, the big party or something. But, you know, again, I don't want to rule that out for anybody who does. I'm just saying I agree with your statement about, you know, kind of pushing back against the what we'll call the drum roll narrative, which I think is to use your word.
Well, just back to the subject of ground effect real quick. Where do you think this play is going to go from here?
Well, I love, you know, it's funny because I have a really close relationship with Nashville Rep in Nashville, Tennessee, and they are such a great theater. I've been really lucky to be a resident there in the Ingram New Works program, and I would love to perform or have this play performed, you know, back in those areas. You know, I know a great musician named Eric Holm, and he always says that his music is it goes out to queer kids in red states, and there's a part of me that wants to really embrace that. Like, I think to have it, you know, on a New York stage, well, everybody loves that. But I think if we start to think about, well, where do I really need to, who do I need to tell this to? I think who I need to tell this to is queer kids in red states. I want them to know that even though politically, I think we're in a really rough spot, there are people out there that are just like you, and they're fighting for you, and they're telling one story in which hopefully will grow to be a library of stories. And hopefully all those queer kids in red states and queer kids everywhere will add to that library with their own stories. And that's who I really want to tell it to. So my hope, honestly, if we're talking technicalities here, is workshop it some more, do another draft, get some actors in a room, and then bring it to queer kids in red states.
I will say, as happy as I am for the plethora of beautiful new art that has been created in the past 3.5 years. Yep. I cannot express with enough of my heart how much I hope we come to a point soon where we do not have the same reason to produce these stories. We're
Amen.
Almost through. We're almost through.
Amen to that. Just, yeah.
Either 1 or 5 more years. Well, wow. Before we wrap up, because we got into some heavy topics there, I always like to wrap up with fun little theater question. Yeah. And just in the interest of continuing on our gender conversation, mm-hmm. If you could, this is a pretty good one, I think. Mm-hmm. If you could either swap the gender or go completely gender neutral, non-binary on any pre-existing protagonist of any pre-existing play. Doesn't matter if it's classical, modern, whatever. Who would you pick and why, and how do you think that would affect their story?
Well, see, that's a great question because I have to resist the urge right away to basically pick the playwright I think that would piss off the most and just choose that one because I know they'd hate it. Like, I know David Mamet would hate that, so I just kind of want to resist, like, being like, oh, yeah, Glengarry Glen Ross. Because, but, you know, because that energy isn't good. So let me think seriously about that because that's a great question.
You would think within 3 years of doing this podcast, I would think up the question prior to the episode, or B, prep the playwright in any semblance of advance to give them a chance to answer. I will say if you do need a moment, I can cut out any gaps in silence.
Okay, that's good to know. That basically means I don't have to keep hemming and hawing too much because I really do want to think about this, and I'll give you an answer right now. But I do want to think about it. Let's see. So any play from any period in history. Okay, I got it.
All right,
good. I got it. And you know, this is my answer tonight.
My line is always open if you need to imagine.
Excellent. So here's my answer. And it's very much spun off of our conversation about ground effect. In the South, in Sevierville, in Gatlinburg, in those areas, it is very common for very sort of predictable plays to be performed as dinner theater in like big sort of stadium style scene, like kind of a medieval times, but not for the Middle Ages, more for you know like Southern things. And so I would take there's one show that they do called The Hatfields and the McCoys, and I would take that show, which is exactly what you would expect out of Gatlinburg, Tennessee. I would take that show and play with gender so much to make it the queerest thing you've ever seen. And I would let those audiences come in there with the, you know, expectations of having their chicken and their tomato soup and, you know, whatever other very low cost foods they could kind of throw at you for $50 a pop, and let them sit down, watch that, and just make it totally, totally, totally queer, like completely subvert those expectations gender wise. And I think they'd probably burn that theater down by the end of it. But I think that it would be well worth it because there is the message behind that is queerness has always been here. It's always been in this place. And by inventing these strictly solely cishet, very white also plays, and sort of selling that as the brand of that place, you're actually doing a disservice to the history of that place, which is quite queer and quite POC and et cetera, quite immigrant as well. And that's why I would choose that. So I'm sure there are more famous plays that we could choose. But right now, I think based on our conversation, it's going to be the Hatfields and McCoys dinner show in Gatlinburg, Tennessee, making it totally trans non-binary and really just tearing that place apart.
It is certainly the most unique play anyone has ever given me when I've asked them a play hypothetical.
Well, there you go.
Well, Jonathan, thank you so much for chatting with me today. This chat went a lot longer than they usually do, but I enjoyed every minute of it, and I did not want it to stop.
Me too.
So, and for any playwrights out there, aspiring or otherwise, if you have a play in any state that you would like feedback on, please send it to submissions@elephantroomproductions.com. Remember, every story deserves to be heard, so join our elephant herd today. Until next time, this is Robert Gene Pelleccio, signing off.